If you're still struggling with consent, just imagine instead of initiating sex, you're making them a cup of tea.
Consent. It's really at the heart of the sexual assault case against Bill Cosby. The idea is simple and complicated at the same time. But maybe this British guy can break it down in a way we all can understand.
You say, hey, would you like a cup of tea? And they go, oh my God, I would love a cup of tea. Thank you. Then you know they want a cup of tea.
Seems pretty straightforward, right? That yes to tea means yes to sex. No to tea means no to sex. But what if someone doesn't or can't say yes or no to tea?
If you say, hey, would you like a cup of tea? And they're like, I'm not really sure. Then you can make them a cup of tea, or not. But be aware that they might not drink it. And if they don't drink it, then, and this is the important bit, don't make them drink it. Just because you made it doesn't mean you're entitled to watch them drink it.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Cosby Unraveled. I'm your host, Annette John Hall. Andrea Constant wasn't asked if she wanted any tea when she arrived at Bill Cosby's house for career advice in January of 2004. Cosby gave her three pills, friends, he called them, and a glass of wine that he said would take the edge off. Constant took the pills. She said she thought they were herbal and says she soon lost her strength and awoke to Cosby sexually assaulting her. He said he didn't hear her say no. She said she was too out of it and couldn't say anything. It was somewhere between permission and rejection. That's how Cosby described the sexual encounter in a 2005 deposition. That she agreed to take the pills is not up for dispute. What this case boils down to is whether or not she agreed to sex.
In this type of case, it's so much a he said, she said situation. And so the question of consent is hard to prove because they have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the criminal standard.
Dr. Jill Huntley Taylor is a trial consultant who prepares witnesses and advises attorneys on jury selection. Consent is the same issue the jury had to deal with in the first trial, which ended in a mistrial.
He said himself, I think it was in a 2005 deposition, when they were asking him, would you use the word consent? He said, I don't want to use that word.
Bobby Dugan was on the first jury. He told Dateline NBC that Cosby's refusal to use the word consent convinced him to convict. He said one key element could have made a big difference in the case.
Evidence. If there is other evidence, more substantial evidence, we would have had a better verdict.
So I'm here in Norristown with WHYY reporter Dana DeFilippo, who's been here for the past 3 weeks covering the trial. So Dana, you've been here. How's this playing out to you?
It's really hard to say at this point which way things might go. It's been a trial that is now in its third week, and it seemed like a couple times during the trial that things weren't really going the defense's way. There was a number of new things that the judge allowed this time around that a lot of people kind of saw as damaging to the defense, to Cosby's side. But then they did their closing arguments, and Tom Mesereau and Kathleen Bliss were actually quite strong, and they gave jurors quite a bit to chew on. So there was quite a bit of new evidence this time around, too, speaking of things to chew on, and one was the settlement. That was almost $3.4 million, and the judge didn't allow the settlement in the first trial, so it was seen as a major victory for the defense that he allowed it in this time. And one of the reasons for that is because the defense has been trying to paint Andre Constant as this greedy liar. And so that backs up their argument that she was in this for the money and that she would say anything to get money. The settlement works for the prosecution too, because the prosecutors were saying that Cosby and Constant signed a confidentiality agreement. And so that suggests that Cosby has something to hide. Andrew Wyatt, who is Cosby's spokesman, tried to downplay the settlements. He actually called it, quote, a small amount of money that Cosby paid to make something unpleasant.
Wait a minute. Excuse me, $3.4 million is a small amount of money?
I suppose when you're a world-famous comedian, maybe it is, I guess.
No, not for us. I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah, I don't think I'll have that much money my whole life, but goals.
So, Dana, this time around, 5 additional witnesses were allowed to testify who weren't allowed to testify the last time, and that was considered one of the key moments of the trial. What difference did those witnesses make this time around?
Actually, I think those witnesses were quite strong. There were 5 very different women, but with 5 very similar stories. And most importantly, their story was very similar to what Andrea Constand said in terms of the drugging and the losing consciousness or awareness, and then waking up, you know, either naked or partially naked in bed or in some kind of compromising position or actually in the middle of a sex act.
Wow. And then, of course, there was Janice Dickinson, who was one of those 5 witnesses, and tell me about her. How did she do up there on the stand?
She was fascinating. So she was a model, and she's kind of a wild card. She had a few testy exchanges with Cosby's attorneys. She got off the stand and with a kind of a nod to the judge and told him he did a good job, and then announced to kind of whoever was listening, you know, Law and Order is my favorite show. So that got a bunch of laughs. And she was actually a really compelling witness for that reason, too, because, you know, in a trial that drags on for 3 weeks, things can get really tedious and boring. She got the few laughs that came out of this trial.
Was there any other evidence this time around, Dana, that you think could possibly sway a jury?
Yes, so the defense team brought in a witness. Her name is Marguerite Jackson, and she's a longtime Temple employee, and she, at the time, was an academic advisor for the women's basketball team. She said that she roomed with Andrea Constand a few times, including once when they were watching a news program on TV, and up popped a story about a celebrity who was getting sued for having an improper relationship with a woman. And I guess the woman was going after money. And so, according to Marguerite Jackson, Andrea Constand said, "That happened to me once." And Jackson said, "What? Are you serious?" And finally, she says that Andrea said, "No, actually, it didn't happen to me, but I could say that it did, and I could get a bunch of money, and I could quit my job."
So, Dana, there was a very special supporter who came to court to support Cosby.
Yes, Camille Cosby showed up for the day of closing arguments.
And we might say that Camille Cosby is the wife of Bill Cosby.
Yes, she's been his wife for 5 decades. And she walked into the courtroom where Bill Cosby was already seated at the defense table and walked up to him. He stood, and they kind of stood there for just a minute or two. It was actually quite sweet. They pressed foreheads together and stood kind of talking quietly and then shared a kiss. And then she went and sat down with the rest of the spectators to watch the closing arguments.
So, Dana, I know that you don't have a crystal ball and you can't predict what the jury is going to decide, but who had the strongest case?
The prosecution really did have a strong case with the 5 additional witnesses. We're in a different era now with this Me Too movement, and the 5 additional women who were allowed to testify against him, I think, were really compelling. You know, there was a common theme to all of their testimony. I think that's going to be hard to ignore. That may be the thing that the jurors most grapple with.
Well, I'm going to let you get back into that courtroom, Dana DeFilippo. Thank you so much for sharing your views with us today.
Thank you, Annette, for having me.
Last time, the jury deliberated for 52 hours, that's 4.5 days, before Judge Stephen O'Neill declared a mistrial. They just couldn't come up with a unanimous verdict. Dr. Taylor says, in hindsight, the unresolved outcome is not surprising.
The allegations were so long ago. Cosby is so beloved. I mean, I think those are the 2 main reasons that I was not surprised.
A jury is a complex body made up of a lot of different personalities and emotions. After all, they're made up of our peers. They're walking along, living their lives, and suddenly, they're part of a celebrity trial and the whole world is watching. It's a lot of pressure. Again, juror Bobby Dugan.
You're stuck in a small room with 11 other people. The one little thing that one person might do will drive you insane. The most intense moment, I think, was when there's about 4 people crying in the room. One was out in the hallway, pacing, you know, visibly upset. They just couldn't handle it.
While jurors typically have good intentions, Dr. Taylor says they don't always follow instructions.
Even juries that are not sequestered are given
a ton of admonitions of don't go online, don't Google, don't. They do. I mean, that's just human nature to try to get as much information as you can to make a decision. And I'm not saying people do it and they're ignoring the judge, but it does happen. And it's sometimes it's kind of innocent. It just happens because people want to know. They want to make the right decision. And people feel that the more information they have to make that decision, the better.
Occasionally, she says a juror might even have their own motive.
I think that jurors are very honest. They work really hard. They want to do a good job. But there are some jurors who like the idea of sitting on this case. It is a celebrity. It is kind of a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And so there could be people with an agenda. We call them stealth jurors. There's like a name for it. They want to be on the jury. They want to send a message to one party or the other, or they, you know, they're motivated. Those people are rare. But they exist. And this is the kind of case that you would see them if they are out there.
Rogue jurors who are Googling, stealth jurors with their own agendas, well-intentioned jurors trying to do the right thing. They all have to come to a unanimous verdict based on two opposing narratives spun by the prosecution and the defense. Some jurors might believe Andrea Constant in this case, but they might not be willing to put Cosby in that orange jumpsuit.
They could believe that he did this. And think, do we need to put him in jail? Jurors can hold these different ideas in their minds at the same time. I think he's morally a bad guy. I think he probably did what she says he did. But I don't really, you know, he's 80. And that can come into play in how they decide these cases, even if it's not legally relevant.
At this point, the jury probably wants to go home. They've been on an emotional roller coaster with attorneys going at it, tears from witnesses, and Janice Dickinson. But aside from the tedium and the drama, their task is still to focus on just one thing.
At the end of the day, all the rest of this is just movement around that issue. Did she consent or did she not consent?
What do you think? Next time on Cosby Unraveled, making the punishment fit the crime.
I think either way, Cosby's finished.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Special thanks to musicians Tony Trove and Mike Vivas. To Al Banks for engineering help. Sandra Clark is WHYY's Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Cosby Unraveled was produced by Jeanette Woods and Lindsay Lazarski. I'm Annette John Hall.